Hola, hello, hi, bienvenido, and welcome back or welcome to Mentors Today. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by relatively new friend over the last couple of years, Ali Jamal. Ali's the founding partner at First Check Ventures. Ali's a seasoned operating executive who has established himself as a prominent figure in the world of technology, growth, and product management, building bridges between the U.S. and Latin America. He studied economics and statistics at Stanford and set the stage for a career that now encompasses a whole diverse range of roles and responsibilities. Ali's career journey began on the M&A, on the mergers and acquisition side of the business, where he honed his skills in corporate strategy and development. Over the last decade, he's held various positions at companies, notable companies such as Zynga, RockYou, Agoda, Rappi, Clip, and some of basically Latin America's fastest growing companies, fintech companies, and companies across a variety of industries. So he brings a very unique and extensive experience in consumer-facing tech, and that's allowed him to navigate and contribute to this evolving world that we live in. Now, he's serving part of this economy that we play in as the founder of First Check Ventures, where he plays a crucial role in nurturing and supporting early-stage companies, not only as an angel investor, but also as a trusted advisor with all of that experience that he brings to bear, both in business and life. Ali, my friend, welcome, bienvenido to Mentors Today.
Thank you for having me. That's a really great opening.
Oh, it's your life story, buddy. This should be a good opening, right? Let's give some context geographically. I'm sitting in Los Angeles, as I always do when I do these things. Where are you right now?
I'm calling in from my house in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Awesome. And you were saying just the other day you were?
I was in Guatemala for the volcano summit in Antigua.
Yeah.
And then I just spent last week in Mexico City. So I got a chance to be in Guatemala, Mexico City the last couple of weeks, but awesome. Today I'm calling in from home and glad to be back.
I was going to say, nice to be at home for a few days amidst the craziness. Let's talk about you, buddy. Like I love to say on the show, I love the product. I love the process, AKA the companies, but I really love getting to them through the story of the person, because I think that's the most human way to tell all of our stories. So let's strip it down to the super starting point level. Like, what's your story? Like, where were you born? And like, what was the journey? And how does that kid, how does young Ali get to Stanford?
Yeah. So I was actually born in Vancouver, but we left when I was 3 years old. So I actually grew up in northern Minnesota in a very small town called Virginia, Minnesota.
Didn't even know that existed. There we go.
The town was about 9,000 people. And so it was like a really interesting atmosphere. I kind of like to reference it in some ways to, if anybody knows the show, The Wonder Years. It felt very similar to that, right? Where okay. It was a small town. Everybody kind of knew everybody. You could go from your friend's house and walk to the other friend's houses. Like if you caused trouble, your parents would know before you got home. Remember a couple times, you know, I got home and I was already getting yelled at because somebody had called my parents and tell them I was up to no good, you know, with my hoodlum friends. And, you know, I think there's a lot of negatives that people associate with kind of being in a small place and not having a lot of access to opportunities. But there's also like this opportunity to kind of experiment and explore in a way that I think is sometimes easier than in a big place where it's like overly competitive. And so you could go and do things. You didn't have to be the best at them right away. And you could figure out what your real passions were. And so I feel like I was probably somewhat naturally talented at a lot of different things.
A bit of a young generalist.
Yeah. And so I did a lot of different things, but that led me to not really know what I wanted to do kind of going forward and what I really wanted to be a part of going forward. And so part of what led me to Stanford, I think, was really that confusion where I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into medicine or become a lawyer or whatever. And a lot of schools, I felt like, especially a lot of top schools, really kind of specialized in one thing and you had to really know what you were doing. And then a lot of them even made you choose, like before you applied, like you had to apply to go to a business school, you had to apply to go to a biology program or whatever. And I didn't want to choose. Maybe I hate choices. I don't know. But one of the beauties about Stanford for me was that it gave you these couple years to go and explore, and you could take top classes in other departments. There's this big kind of emphasis on being more experimental and building a stronger foundation of knowledge. And then kind of whichever program you ended up with, it was probably going to be pretty strong, right? Like I feel like they had pretty good sciences and computer science and mathematics, but also really good humanities departments, and just be able to get that chance to learn from really great professors and not feel like, oh, I went to the school, so I had to do this one thing. To me, right. It was really important.
That's awesome. I talk about that a lot with education friends. I just say this idea that in the educational system, like our culture, we moved away from that, right? Which was essentially college for those that were able to or qualified for or were privileged enough to attend. Way back in the day, the whole purpose was that you went and you explored and you learned how to learn, yeah. Right? And you learned a variety of different things. Frankly, you were supposed to come out like a better human, right? More well-rounded, more thoughtful, more self-aware. And somewhere, you know, around the time that we also figured out how to finance it for the masses, we seemed to also then turn it into like it's a job factory, right? And the whole purpose of going. And as you said, in that super, even now it bleeds down. My daughter, probably a little bit younger than you, and I saw the same thing with her. She wound up going to Berkeley, go Bears. And I had the same kind of vibe of like that hyper-competitiveness was down at like the high school level. So yeah, that's good for you. So you are at an early age, you were, hey, I'm the idyllic, friendly, but you know, occasionally maybe not troublesome, but you know, mischievous guy in your perfect suburban neighborhood area that you grew up in, and didn't quite know what he wanted to be when he grew up, so to speak.
Yeah, and there's that like quote, like some of the most interesting 4-year-olds still don't know what they want to be, and I think I might be falling into that category, right? Like I feel like I'm still evolving and still changing, and I think we can kind of continue to grow your skill sets and you continue to evolve. And if you're consistently doing that, the things that fit you really well 5 years ago should no longer fit you now, right? Like right. We should constantly be expanding who we are and why we're doing the things that we're doing. And I think I've started to finally click on a lot of things and, you know, that didn't make sense in the past, but are now finally all come together for me. And I'm really excited by that. But
Because now we know, looking back, like it turns out you were destined to be a venture investor. Like that was the story the whole time. We just didn't know that's what it was. So, all right. So how do we go? How does this guy from Virginia, Minnesota, go from there to Stanford? And then Stanford, how do we wind up as deeply immersed in Latin America as you did?
Yeah. So, you know, to go from like high school to Stanford, I guess, part of it, yeah, I just didn't know better, right? Like I just didn't know what like you are capable of or what you're not capable of. And I was like actually like one of the first people from my high school, I think, to get into Stanford in like 20 years. But, you know, I just did my own recruiting and you know, was super gung-ho on trying to see all the different opportunities out there. Because, again, I was coming from a place where I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I applied to a bunch of schools. And at least at that time, it was a crazy number. I think it was like 20. I think now that's probably like the standard or less of the standard. But right. Back then, like my parents and my counselors thought I was like crazy and I got yelled at. Like, why are you spending all this money on?
I was just going to say, like now the application fees are probably 5x what they were then. So 20 now would be like $4,000 just to apply to school.
Yeah, I think it was I got some waivers and things like that. Like I'd try to get in whenever I could just to see. But I just wasn't sure how people would accept this small town kid and like what it would be transitioning into a larger, different environment. And so I applied to a lot of different schools and luckily I got into a lot. And then Stanford actually invited me to admit weekend. And so I got a chance to see it up close see the students and understand more about what it was like. And it was just really kind of mind blowing to me. And I think part of it was also a little bit of the attitude of Stanford, which is kind of like a little bit more West Coast, a little bit more, we're going to be really smart, but we're also going to, you know, not be as rigid, not be as fundamental about things.
Right. We're going to go hike on the weekend or surf or
exactly.
we're going to go eat tacos and wear shorts and
kind of embracing that kind of rebel attitude. Right. I think to a certain extent that like, hey, we can build things, we can do things that are different. We can change the world. And so I think that was also pretty exciting for me. So decided to go to Stanford and got to Stanford. And it was a, you know, kind of a mind blowing experience, I think, for somebody from, you know, a small town where I kind of knew the same kids since kindergarten. And we were all, you know, all kind of grew up together. Now you're in this environment at Stanford where you have just such amazing talent. In high school, I was like a 3-sport athlete. And, you know, I get to Stanford and my roommate is the number one tennis recruit in the country that year. And goes on to win the NCAAs in tennis. And then the guy two doors down is on the Olympic team for water polo. And you know, you kind of have all these like crazy geniuses all around you, and it really puts you in your place, right? So,
and like, people from, like, again, connected to kind of your later life chapter where you wind up in Latin America and working for all these cool, crazy companies, like people from all over the world, right? So you're not just getting like, you're this kid from small town Minnesota. You're not just getting like, oh, the big city exposure of the Bay Area. You're getting exposed to the brightest, most talented kid from Italy and from the UK and from China and from Guatemala and Hong Kong and Mexico City. And like, so you're getting the best and brightest. Suddenly you're like a citizen of the world.
Yeah. And you kind of get that exposure. And I traveled a bit before that, right? But you tend to go to like kind of very touristy places and kind of stay in your tourist bubble. And I mean, especially as a 15, 6-year-old kid, right? They're not really going to let you out of the wild, nor probably should they. But, you know, now you're kind of meeting people who actually were in these places and had this kind of greater life experience that you can kind of just learn from and soak up from, and just different attitudes. And then at the same time, right, they kind of all had, I don't know, kind of what I would consider like the Stanford spirit, right? This kind of Stanford desire to not just impact the world financially, but also like make it a better place, and going off of that kind of vibe, right? Like continue trying to figure out where I fit into this whole world. And again, you had kind of come to Stanford not knowing exactly what I wanted to do, getting there, now being even more confused. And instead of thinking, oh, I'm this genius that can do everything, realizing, hey, I'm an idiot that probably can't do nothing. And I have to like really figure that out. So I spent a lot of time kind of going through different majors and going through different programs and trying to figure out, okay, where did I fit in and what could I do with it? And so part of that was like through the classroom side and trying out different majors. Part of it was through different like clubs and organizations and trying to figure out what's my clique and where can I really fit in.
Yeah.
And then part of it was also just like from the work front. So I wanted to get as much exposure to different types of jobs as quickly as possible. So I did internships in things like private equity at hedge funds. I went and worked at some tech companies. So really try to take advantage of being in Silicon Valley and kind of constantly bouncing around and exploring. And, you know, I think the interesting thing at that time was kind of, this is back in the early 2000s, was the advice I got for both people in tech and people in finance was go do investment banking. And I don't think that would be the advice now. And I think everybody would now kind of give you opposite advice, but at the time that's what you're supposed to do. And so, you know, kind of still realizing I'm a dumb kid and I don't know exactly what I want to do with my life. I figure if this is what all these super smart people tell me to do, let's go do it. And so I started my career in investment banking because I was supposed to be an investment banker and you're supposed to be this kind of, I don't know, Patrick Bateman wannabe. And I hated it. And I felt like I was being punished for using my brain. And it was just kind of like torture. But at the same time, you know, I didn't want to give up. And so I ended up like kind of in this weird situation trying to be something I wasn't for so long. And after kind of 3 years of investment banking, I was like, I've kind of had enough of this. I can't do this anymore. Yeah. I don't want to reach the next level. I look at the people who have, you know, the next level job or the job above that, and I don't really want their jobs. I don't really want their lives.
And that's the track. Like those were corporatist career tracks that like your whole point is to become the partner. Like that's why you're on that track, right?
I looked at the partners and I felt like a lot of them just seemed unhappy, right? They all, you know, were on their second or third wife, hadn't seen their kids in a couple of years. They're spending so much of their time on the road. They're always at a risk of potentially getting fired. It was just this crazy environment where you're unhappy and you make other people unhappy because you want to make yourself feel better by making other people unhappy. I just didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be that. I don't want to get my joy from making other people unhappy. And it seems like a very weird way to live your life. And
just describe like post-late American capitalism, right? now you're trying to do the better version of it going forward.
I think that's the beauty, right, of something like venture capital is like, to a certain extent, like I only win if you win. If you lose, I lose, right? Like my incentives are directly tied with yours as your business partner. There's no way really for me to win with you losing, right? And or it's very hard at least.
But to something we said in your bio, in the intro, right? Like it was a chapter, regardless, you learned that wasn't a fit for you. But like it winds up being a chapter where you get to sharpen your chops, so to speak, right? You got to kind of sharpen your skills and understand corporates and how corporates work and why companies buy and or get sold, right? Why companies acquire assets, why intellectual property or technology is important.
And just some fundamental skills, right, around things like valuation and growth, and some of these things that ended up serving me well. I think I kind of ended up developing this hybrid skill set where I started with M&A and then went and spent some years as a data scientist. And then, you know, at companies like Zynga and RockYou, I started to work as a product manager and started to combine some of these things, like into how do we think about acquiring other companies at RockYou and what does the product look like? How do we think about that? What does their data look like? What can we learn and what can we value their data? And from like an M&A standpoint, so being able to like wear all these different hats at once kind of built up my skill set in a unique way that now is even serving me, I think, even more in venture.
Did you, I'm curious, because again, there's a whole chapter of your career that we described. You didn't go from like, I have a realization, I don't want to work in investment banking, to I want to launch my own fund. Like you, there's a life in between there. And you just said something I want to pull on this thread a little bit. Like at some point in your both educational and experiential journey, it sounds like, you tell us, did you kind of fall in love with like the data side of things?
I'd always loved data in numbers, and it was something I was kind of just naturally good at. And so, you know, that's part of the reason why I went to get a master's in stats. Part of the thing that I just felt like always like very comfortable with, I guess, was numbers. I think kind of just how my mind naturally works oftentimes is in kind of percentages and chances and in, you know, kind of the relationship between things I usually tend to put into some sort of analytical framework.
Yeah. You're, as I would describe in my social circles, you're a numbers guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and so you were a numbers guy, even though you weren't enjoying the application of the numbers stuff in the investment banking track.
Yeah.
Like you were at your root a numbers guy. And so you come out of that and was there like a relationship? Was there an opportunity that presented itself or something that said like, hey, was Zynga the first one? Like was somebody like, hey, come to work at Zynga? Or did you seek out like, all right, I got to get out of investment banking?
Yeah. So I really needed to get out of investment banking and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. And so I kind of interviewed at a couple different firms and I actually made the jump into data science first. So I worked as a data scientist for 3 years. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of the exact opposite of investment banking in my mind, where an investment banking is all about how much can you produce and like making sure everything's on a deadline. And like to a certain extent, I think fairly low quality of work. They're just expected to like churn and churn and churn until it gets better. That's not actually how I like to work. Like I like to work with kind of putting my best effort in. Maybe I do small revisions later, but really kind of putting it out and having the framework. So spending a lot of time kind of thinking and then creating with the smaller amount of time and then revising, you know, only what needs to. And, you know, kind of what I learned is that's actually a lot about how kind of the data or data science that I was doing actually worked as well. Like it wasn't things necessarily where you could kind of just jump right in and have a solution. You need to kind of take a step back and think about how are these different pieces related? What are we actually trying to figure out? What are we really trying to drive? And then using data and analytics to kind of unlock some of those values.
Sounds a little bit more like your mind works a little bit more relationally and a little less transactionally.
Yes.
Yeah. And so the investment banking world was asking you to like get to a transaction, right? And you're like, wait, I want to explore the problem some more.
Yeah. I think, you know, I get a little bit more satisfaction out of kind of completing like a longer project and seeing things that other people didn't see, kind of coming in from a different angle. And so I felt like the kind of the just pure production and you know, numbers for just numbers sake, isn't really that valuable, right? If something anybody can do it, then I don't really want to do it. I want to do something where I could really add value. I could really take it to the next level.
So post data science stretch of a couple of years was the first corporate, like, okay, now I'm going to go help grow something. Was that Zynga?
So, yeah, so exactly. So you kind of had done data science for a few years and really enjoyed it, but wanted a chance to get my hands a little bit dirtier. I felt like data science is a little bit too theoretical and I love the theory, but I realized like, you know, you're never going to really be able to just continue doing theory. Like the more you do theory, the less you kind of feel.
Unless you're going to go back and get a job as an associate professor at Stanford.
Yes. And so at that time, the kind of big thing that was emerging was kind of product management. So I kind of got to be a data scientist before data science was really a thing. And then I said, hey, let's go be a product manager before product manager is really a thing. And so at that time, you know, product management was just kind of started to evolve. And the big applications for it were a lot in kind of mobile and gaming. And so I got to see a lot with some of these different gaming companies. And then I made the jump into Zynga to work as a product manager there.
Which, for context, for like non-gamer, non-mobile gamer person like me, but business junkie, and maybe for people who are even less informed, Zynga, like, global giant.
Yeah. They were like one of the first big Facebook games. I don't know if everybody hopefully remembers Farmville, but Farmville was theirs. When, you know, you were throwing a cow at people. That was all them. They also ended up owning like Words with Friends, and they had a bunch of other games at the time, both on Facebook and then eventually kind of also on mobile.
So for data science guy who loves, is kind of fascinated by like the business applications of stuff and markets, like you were playing in the major leagues, right? Yeah. Like you were early as product manager learning a new discipline, but like you're playing in like at the top levels.
Yeah. And I think having that background in data actually was extremely valuable to me at Zynga, just because I could go and pull my own information and go and make my own guesses or assumptions or digging in. And so most of the time people would have to wait for the data science. It's like one data science for like 10 PMs. Whereas I could be like the 1 PM who would go and do my own queries, come back and get things 10 times faster in that sense.
Yeah.
It really made a difference in my ability to be effective as a product manager. And it was also something I was really respected, I think, within these companies and within product, to being kind of more data driven and more analytical. And so I think different types of product managers, you know, it could have a very loose title or whatever. And so I think some are more design focused or some are more engineering focused, but at least a lot of the gaming industry was very kind of data focused. And so I think it was like a great fit as an evolution in my career.
And at some point, back to the geographic question, right? Like, so how do you go to work from some of those OG beast companies to some that listeners of our show will know and appreciate, but how do you go to wind up working for some of like Mexico and Latin America's biggest, hottest companies?
Yeah. So, you know, first I made the jump to Asia and I got recruited by a company in Asia called Agoda. And so I moved to Thailand and I ended up basically becoming their CMO for China and spending a lot of my time in China as well as in Thailand. And kind of seeing the rise of different trends in Asia, you know, I'd visited Asia before 5, 6, 7 years before that, and seeing the evolution that had happened there over that time and how much to credit technology was. Maybe it sounds weird that it was so late in you know, coming out of Silicon Valley, but it's like I finally understood the power of technology and how much it could really unlock, you know, and it didn't just have to be whatever the stupid things that were being built in the Valley at the time, right? Like pizza delivery robots, you could actually go and build things to make, you know, people's lives better and easier.
That was again, a lot of people didn't know it. I was even earlier, like while you were still schooling, I was 2003 to 2008 in China, India, Southeast Asia, in a bunch of different things in traditional industries. But even then, yeah. Right, like you were seeing like early days consumer technologies that just, I would come home and I'd be like, why don't we have this? Right. Like, or why isn't this embedded into our world? Or things like, before I ever had a friend in Latin America say, hey, no, the only way we text with each other or talk to each other is on this thing called WhatsApp. I had already known for years and years and years and been using WeChat, right, with my friends to keep in touch when I wasn't in their region. And then when I was there, using it like they would use it. So I can imagine, like, you're like, hey, I thought like I knew what was going on. And then you go there and you're like, holy cow, wait a minute.
Exactly. And so I started thinking about like, where could these things truly be unlocked and where could there really be a lot of power from it? And one of the things that was really fascinating to me at the time was super apps and looking at super apps and kind of taking some of the different things that I thought were frustrating in some of my previous roles or previous jobs, right? And so, you know, working at Agoda, one of the things that was, I thought, challenging, what was the differences between cultures, right? And people in Thailand look and discriminate and talk differently than people in Vietnam or in people in Malaysia or Singapore or whatever. And so every time you were doing something, you had to adapt it to that local community and you had to put in new people into the ads. And you wouldn't know if the ads would still resonate, if they would still sound with the same, you know, whatever. And so it just felt like every time you have something new, you have to kind of like recreate the wheel a little bit for each of these new regions. And, you know, I traveled throughout Latin America before and I had friends that were there and it didn't really feel like that was really the case there. Like it felt to me like, all right.
A bit more homogeneity.
Yeah.
It's 33 different countries. It's like unique culture, but there's some more bonds that tie it together than Southeast Asia. Yeah.
And you know, look, people from Argentina might look different than people from Peru or their Spanish might be slightly different, but there was this kind of more openness, I think, to migration and to, you know, when you look at cities like Mexico or Buenos Aires, they really are, at least in my mind, much more international and much more welcoming to different types of people and to different types of culture.
And so you're sitting in Asia and you're contemplating like your next chapters and phases and you're looking around the world and you're like tapping into some personal anecdotal experiences through friends about, okay, I traveled there. Yeah, I went and visited that Argentinian buddy of mine from school. Like what? And you're already kind of piecing together, like, wait a minute, where could I take, if I'm hearing it correctly, like where could I take what I'm learning and what I've learned and then look to the next markets where we could actually like really do scaled up types of growth and impact.
Yes.
And where would there be fewer problems that I'm seeing in the world that I'm living in now? And literally just like research brain, data science guy, looked at Latin America and went, oh, there.
Yeah.
Okay. So
it's very much a data-driven decision, I think, in the beginning. And then once I got there, right, and it kind of became much more of an emotional one, right? And I really started to feel much more connected, much more welcomed in Latin America than I had felt in other places. I started to really kind of fall in love with the entrepreneurial spirit here. I got to see how many great companies were being built. And it wasn't something that was being highlighted in the U.S. or in Silicon Valley or whatever. And so like once I ended up getting to Rappi and moving to Colombia and really being welcomed in Colombia in a way that I hadn't felt in other places. Like
since life in Virginia, Minnesota?
I mean, maybe since life initially at Stanford, right? Like when you're like kind of this wide-eyed freshman coming to school and everybody
you meet your best buddy and your friends for
And within my first week or two in Colombia, I'd already made some friends. They'd invited me to their houses. Like it was just like this weird thing that like I lived in Thailand for 2 years. I never got invited to any Thai person's house. I spent a ton of time in China. I never got invited to any Chinese person's house. And even in just a short time in Colombia, it was happening. And you know, just kind of seemed magical, right?
And a great human cultural, sociocultural validation of your underlying data.
Yeah.
Right. So like most people wind up in Latin America or wherever they wind up because of a personal connection, a relationship, a human pull. You do the data approach and you wind up in arguably one of the most like emotion first human cultural places on the planet. And then immediately like, that's like, oh, okay. So the data was like great. Cause I think there's a huge upside here, but the validation is ironically not more data. It's just human data points.
Yeah. And you know, meeting the people, seeing how open they are to outsiders and how open they are to learning, right? Like I ultimately think what's going to cause success or failure is how open we are to outside ideas and how much we can kind of use that competition of ideas to make ourselves better. And I feel like Latin America really has this, you know, strong desire to make itself better through immigration, right? And you know, when I've worked in places like Rappi or like Clip, you know, they both made big emphasis to bring in people, the best talent globally, wherever it was from, right? So bringing in people from India, bringing in people from China, bringing in people from Africa to come work Europe, right? Like all over the world, they were already bringing them in, right? And it felt like it was part of their culture to try to get better in a way that I haven't felt or seen from other markets as much. I don't think other markets are as open to outsiders.
Yeah. My personal reflection, I've always felt like after 8 years in the region that there was like a divide socially that there wasn't in other places. And what I mean by that is like, so the older generation of Latin Americans, Mexicans, et cetera, like are much more entrenched in the traditional industry and corporatism and kind of, or just like fighting to survive. And then the younger generation say like, you know, probably now like sub 40, but say maybe like sub 35-ish then, were just all about like, wait a minute, we have to, like, we desperately need to build better. Like, because we aspired more than just getting by or being grateful and humbly not disrupting the status quo. And so there was always this kind of, and like the old guard, like they were like, cool, do whatever you're doing. Like, I don't care. Right. Like because I'm up here. Whereas in Asia, specifically to Asia, like culturally, right, it's much more like top to bottom, familially, from the oldest generation to the youngest. Like, you're just supposed to get on the train, like, and you're supposed to just be the next cog in the wheel that keeps it moving forward. And so that to me was always like the, and this is a negative word, but I'm trying to spin it in a positive way. Like, that was the gap where there was an opportunity to exploit opportunity. Right. Which is, seems to be what you found was like, there's an opportunity gap here.
Yeah. And I think in Latin America, right, like, one of the interesting things is just how much of a community there is around this. I could live in Europe or in Africa or in India or whatever, and I don't know if you would ever really be able to tap into the same kind of network that you could tap into Latin America very easily. Yeah. Like, I could get most of the unicorn founders in Latin America to respond to my email within the next week, right? Like, either directly or reaching out through a warm connection. You know, that's not happening if I try to email Elon Musk or something, right?
Right.
There's just this greater sense of, I think, community and trying to help one another out. And so I see a lot more collaboration. Like, I look at a lot of cap tables, right? So most of the cap tables, at least of the very successful companies, also have people from other successful companies on there, right? And there's this sense of helping each other, being part of the next generation, giving it forward, that I think maybe exists in other places, but is really kind of embodied by what I see in Latin America.
That's awesome. And so you put in some time in work, again, with some of these leading companies we talked about in your intro. So at some point, or what point, do you say, like, okay, wait a minute, like, I see a new level of opportunity for me personally and in the market, which is to invest.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there was a stage that before you turned it into First Check Ventures, when it was just Ali Investing, right? But like, talk about that transition.
Yeah. So I've been investing kind of casually on the side for probably about a decade in startups, you know, some direct investments, you know, friends, startups, things like that. And then I'd actually become pretty active on a platform called AngelList. And so I joined, you know, what they call syndicates, which are groups. So I joined a bunch of these groups on AngelList where they show you deals. I started making some investments. Actually, I had made some investments in Latin America even before I moved there officially. So had some introduction to the ecosystem and was paying attention to what was going on.
Sure.
And then really a lot of it kind of happened during the pandemic. You know, I go from traveling to 15 to 20 countries a year to now kind of 15 to 20 feet between, you know, my bedroom and my office.
Right.
I don't really have that many friends that I can, you know, and no, none of me that I feel comfortable hanging out with in person at this point. Everything's kind of virtual. Everything, you know, is kind of weird reset of time and space, and everything just feels really weird. And I kind of was like, hey, I need something to do to keep myself sane, right? Like, otherwise I might literally just lose it. And so actually very early on in the pandemic, I kind of started, you know, mentoring more and being a little bit more approachable to people, you know, and when people reach out, much more likely to kind of hop on a call with them.
Sure.
Started making some more kind of direct angel investments, and honestly, probably got a little bit ahead of myself and a little bit overly excited, and, you know, kind of ended up blowing through a lot of my capital fairly quickly. And
I love, like, angel investing / venture capital as an anecdote to the pandemic. This is great.
And, you know, I was also kind of this weird thing where, because I just moved to do and started working at Clip, I had a chance to set up my bank accounts, all that stuff. So I actually wasn't getting paid yet, because I had to wait for all this stuff to clear. And so all of a sudden, like, I was looking at my bank account just like dwindling and no money's coming in. I was like, okay, I need to find something else to do besides just this angel investing gambling that's going to maybe pay off in 10 years.
Right. Yeah.
Or I need to figure out some way to make this easier or better. And so I think instead of stopping my addiction, I kind of enabled it by creating a syndicate. And so basically that would allow me to continue to invest in the best startups that I was finding, but also open it up to, you know, friends or friends of friends that could also come in and see the deals that I was doing and invest with me.
And quietly, maybe even unknowingly, I mean, you probably knew it because you were sensitive to all these variables, but if you're 20, 15, 16, 17, and you're doing these types of things, and again, you're not a local, like, you're one of the few that are doing that, right? I mean, because yes, there is intrafamilial support of other founders to other founders in the region, but I mean, 2016, it's still foreigners have no idea. No one's writing checks into Latin America. So you're like quietly just kind of invested, writing checks, doing deals and building up that reputational network, which is way early, like way early.
And so then when I decided to start the syndicate kind of in 2020, I already had somewhat of a track record of getting in front of people. I'd already worked now at two different unicorns in LATAM. So I was kind of getting buy-in from kind of both sides, right? From the U.S. investors that I was this guy from Stanford who worked in the Valley that I kind of knew what I was talking about, from Latin America that I, again, I had those kind of doors in the Valley, but also that I actually had worked here. I knew people here and I could help them. And again, this is really just kind of like a side project to keep myself busy, you know, on nights and weekends. That was also sort of an obsession that kind of just kept on growing, right? So I did my first deal in October of 2020. And then that deal did well. So I did the next one and then another one, and it kind of just snowballed.
But little by little, it sometimes I think we talk about like we're seeking, right? Like we're like, this is, I'm trying to find my way, as you would have described 18-year-old you, right? I'm trying to find my way. I'm exploring. I'm seeking. Now, as you listen to your story unfold and you start to put the chronology together, like you're being pulled. That's how it feels to me. Like you're being pulled forward towards something that was, or a reality that was kind of almost like inevitably waiting for you.
Yeah. So I don't know if you can necessarily like, there's that quote from Steve Jobs, right? Where like, I don't know if you could see the trajectory going forward, but you can kind of see it when you look back. I feel like that's really true, right? There's all these like different steps I took along the way, like into investment banking, into data science, into product management, into international work that, you know, now like all of a sudden it gives me this really unique skill set, this really, you know, different way of looking at the world that I think I can emphasize, like empathize with founders, emphasize their strengths, work with other people and build up something special. This is not like my intent, right? And I feel like I often tell this to like young people I talk to, like your goal should not be to be a venture capitalist. Like if your goal is to be a venture capitalist, there's something wrong with you. Like your goal should be to like help out the ecosystem in whatever way you can. And those that do that, oftentimes, I think we'll eventually become a venture capitalist.
Because if you're doing it the other way around, then, and this is what's happened in my humble opinion in the industry at large, is then you've just siloed venture capital no different than investment banking.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or no different than Big Four consulting, or no different than law school was when I was in college 20 years before you, right? I mean, so it's just like another, oh yeah, I want to be a venture. Why? Well, I don't know, because my friends do, because it'd like look cool on my resume.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you did the more, although you're younger, like you did the more traditional kind of, I'm going to evolve, I'm going to learn, I'm going to explore, I'm going to be a bit of a generalist, I'm going to learn how to operate, I'm going to work on the operating side of industries, I'm going to work in different markets, I'm going to learn different cultures. And then that woman or guy wakes up and goes, oh, the next best way I can impact the economy and make a living and enjoy what I'm doing is by doing this.
Yeah.
Right. Which is combining all my wisdom and experience with these people's money.
And I think the same thing is actually true for entrepreneurship as well. I think we are seeing this kind of rise of entrepreneurship being cool. And especially the last couple of years, it was like the cool thing to do. And so you get all these people that are going and trying to do really weird, unhelpful things. Right. But like, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and make a bunch of NFTs you know, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and go like create some weird cryptocurrency or whatever. Right. And you get like, that's what I think what leads to like a lot of problems in the ecosystem when, you know, you're not trying to solve problems when you're trying to be cool. Right. And I'm not a cool person. You know, I'm fine with that. Right. Like I don't want to be a cool person. I want to be somebody who's helpful, right?
And you're just the kid from Virginia, Minnesota, who didn't know what he wanted to do when he grew up, right?
Yeah, you know, I still don't know. Like this chapter in my life, and I'm really excited by it. But ultimately, what excites me is that ability to help other people, that ability to unlock everybody else's superpowers and shine a light for the ecosystem and help develop it, right?
And
I think, ultimately, right, I feel like good, the more good you do in the world, the more good that comes back to you. And so just trying to take advantage of all these things I've already had access to and being able to add that value to other people.
Good for you. All right. So give me the commercial. Tell us all about First Check Ventures. What's its thesis? Where does it invest? What is it? How many checks does it write? Give us the advertisement.
Yeah. So, you know, I like to invest super early, as the name implies, first check ventures, literally the first check in about 80% of the companies that we invest in. One of the big things for me is, how do I get comfortable with writing that first check? And so for different people, it's different things. One is if it's like a field or a person who I know really well, right? Then I can feel comfortable. But one of the big things that really gives me comfort is, hey, does this thing already exist in some other place, but for some reason doesn't exist here? So what I tend to invest a lot in, especially in Latin America, is these products that have already existed in the US, in Europe, in Asia for quite a while, but for some reason just haven't hit LATAM, right? And there are just a ton of things that haven't hit LATAM yet. And it's a lot of it has to do around kind of finance and fintech and financial services, which I think you see so many financial companies being built. A lot of it has to do with kind of marketplaces that are more inefficient because of lack of access to capital, because of logistical issues. So anything that has to do with kind of adjusting supply chain, optimizing these kind of marketplaces, like those are things that I find really interesting and exciting and big opportunities where there's, I just think there's a lot of waste and a lot of fat that can be eliminated, right?
Sure. So you started as your own, I'm an angel investor, I'm a working guy and I'm using some of my income to write checks into people's companies. Then you get more sophisticated and get into the angel syndicate world of side of things. You organize your own using the AngelList tools as a platform. Is First Check Ventures, does it have outside limited partners? Does it have people that have invested in you? So for people that listen, some don't always know all the lingo. Limited partners are the institutional investors or wealthier people who then invest in people like Ali to manage their money and invest it on their behalf. And so do you have some LPs? Is your own money? Like, what's the mix of the profile look like?
Yeah. So we have LPs, through the syndicate where people are investing in these deals on a deal by deal basis. And so that's
awesome.
The majority of the money is other people's money. Cause I haven't had that exit yet. Right. So yeah. I'm still, a working man.
And good for investors who listen to this thing too, because now Ali is a guy that you could sidle up alongside and take advantage and draft behind Ali's network and his deep sense of the opportunities in Latin America. That's awesome. Talk to me about LATAM going forward, right? So like, obviously, as you and I've alluded to, you came in early. I was around early. Like, we've watched it grow. I was just with a friend who was an integral part of kind of the early days of it last couple of days from Mexico City. And she and I were talking last night kind of like about like, obviously things have changed like since the kind of free cheap capital market has exploded and, is it still like there's still a lot of going on, but it's different. Is it like, so what's your perspective, right? If you and I were just hanging out today, like what do you see today in a snapshot of Latin America and entrepreneurial economy? And then where do you see it, unfolding, say the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. So I'm incredibly bullish on Latin America. There's a couple of big trends and then just a couple of things that just haven't happened yet that really make me excited. Overall, right, Latin America over the last 20 years has seen their middle class double while poverty's been cut in half. And that's amazing, but people still aren't serving that middle class, right? The banks are still for the elites. A lot of the opportunities are still only available if you come from certain zip codes or have certain ties. And I like backing companies that say kind of screw that. We're going to serve everybody. We're going to go and try to serve these people that are underserved, right? And so I think there's these big opportunities to kind of create new financial institutions, new opportunities. Most people in Latin America still don't have access to credit or debt. Less than half of them still have a bank account, right? So just this huge opportunity to kind of bank, give access to credit, give access to debt, and enable kind of this kind of faster velocity of money, right? So much of the money is still kind of just put underneath people's mattresses. And I think there's this—
Literally and metaphorically.
Yes. And I think the more we can speed up the velocity of this, the more investment takes place, the more people can bet on the future, the less people need directly in their hands, and the more they can think about every dollar we earn, how much power that actually can have, right? And so when you don't need to actually save money directly for your groceries in 2 weeks, because you have other money coming in, and it just gives people a better sense of stability.
Yeah.
So I think those are kind of like the big things that I'm thinking about is like, how can we give everyday people that? Now, on the other hand, I think there are like really big positive macro trends that are also going to be accentuated with this. You know, one is just the presence of nearshoring. And I'm guessing people have talked about this previously, but, you know, Mexico is now the U.S.'s number one trading partner as of a couple of weeks ago, or maybe even all year. We don't know exactly, but they've replaced China as number one. There's a lot of really great, interesting and special resources in Latin America that we're going to need more and more access to going forward. There's this wealth of talent and knowledge that is there that as we continue to become a more global society, I think can be unlocked, and the opportunity for these people to help build the future of the technology in the US, I think is really amazing. And so all these things I think are going to kind of continue to happen and grow, right? You have companies from the US that want more employees that use the LATAM to scale. They're going to put more money in. That's going to increase the number of kind of middle class or upper middle class. These are pretty good jobs for LATAM, right? Those people are now going to invest more in their own communities. They're going to have more demands and more services. Then the more money kind of trickles throughout the whole ecosystem. Those people are also going to demand more services. And so you kind of end up having all the different layers of the pyramid that start to get more and more unlocked.
Yeah. Says the data scientist who has spent his young career looking around the globe and traveling around the globe to try and figure out where there was that perfect nexus of opportunity and growth and macro trends and micro realities and cultural anomaly. Like, and you're standing here proudly today saying like, hey, Rob, I think I found it. And I think it's Latin America.
Yeah. And I'm telling people like, look, I'm all in on LATAM, right? Like I live in Latin America. This is the
focus. I was going to say, you're literally all in on it. Like you're not having this conversation with me from Palo Alto. Like you're sitting in Puerto Rico and you just were in Guatemala and you were in New Mexico the week before. Now, when you come home to the US, it's to visit.
Yeah.
Right. That's amazing.
I'm spending my time here. I'm spending my resources, my energy. I think Latin America is the future and I want to help unlock it.
Good for you. If I call you back and it's 2030 and I say like, oh man, we just had the Olympics in LA. This is great. Life is good. The US is more multicultural than ever. Like what's going on with First Check Ventures 7 years from now? What does it look like?
So I'm hoping in 7 years, we will have had our first unicorn, maybe a couple. You know, we started investing in 2020. So that'll be right around the 10-year mark. Hoping we've unlocked some opportunities in some really interesting markets. My first investment we did was actually in Venezuela, of all places. Wow. So we're not only are we investing in Latin America, but in some markets that are overlooked by even most Latin American funds. I hope that continues to be the story, right? Like I want to continue to find great companies in places that are undiscovered. And that,
yeah, you'll probably be the first guy that I'll hear tell a story about like, I found a great opportunity in Paraguay.
Yeah.
Right. I like helped stand up the entrepreneurial economy in Bolivia like that. Like that's because if you're doing it in Venezuela, when it's essentially been locked down by just complete collapse of the government, although ironically, I would tell you from having been in the region what you probably believe, which is like Venezuelans are just kick ass salespeople.
Yeah.
Like Venezuelans. I mean, like people hate when I pick sides, but like Venezuelans and Argentinians could sell like ice cream to Eskimos.
I think part is also like, if you can survive in Venezuela, you can survive anywhere, right? Like,
right.
I think you just have to go through so much.
So 2030 will be on the 10-year cycle of your genre of the fund and all its investments. You'll hope to have cashed out. And is this a lifelong thing? I mean, or like, is this is what you're going to do?
I can't imagine the next thing I'm going to do after this. Like, I don't see it. Again, I didn't think I was going to be doing this though. Like,
right. I was just going to say, like, the world, like, things happen and things get born and created, and the same person that you were that got you through that from Virginia, Minnesota to here is probably going to pique your interests in new other different things as the world evolves.
But maybe it's, you know, some other twist on this, right? Like maybe it's doing a venture studio and coming up with some ideas that I help execute with some founders. Maybe it's doing an accelerator type program. Like there's all these different options of things you can evolve yourself into. I really love the fact that with what I'm doing right now, I could solve more than just one problem at a time. So I don't imagine I would go back to just being an operator. Like, and it's not just an operator, right? Like, don't get me wrong, it's a crazy.
No, but I heard you mean to say like, in like solving one problem with one product in one place, like for some extended period of time, because here you can put your fingers in multiple solutions to multiple problems across a range of places.
as else is, I think, who I am, right? Like, I think I probably have too much like ADHD or whatever. Like, I like to bounce around too much. And I actually, like, the more I learn about the ecosystem, the more I think I would actually be a pretty horrible entrepreneur, which is actually interesting, right? Because I think so many VCs always think they could be a great entrepreneur. And I'm like, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could, like, in some ways I am, right? Like, I am my own entrepreneur. I'm building my own business, but like, I'm building a business in a different way, in a different mindset than if I was doing a app of some sort. And
100% agree. You've said in some of your answers so far that you love, part of what you love about what you do is the ability to teach others, the ability to inspire or mentor others. So guess what, buddy? To finish the show, now we get you to do that right here for us for a couple of minutes. So I'm going to turn you into the mentor for the day. I'm going to ask you to share three pieces of wisdom or perspective or something you've learned from your journey along the way. And it can be to investors, it can be to entrepreneurs, it can be just as humans. But give us, spend a couple of minutes, just give us three pieces of advice that our listeners can take and kind of action, activate in their lives when they listen to this episode.
I think I've got a couple of pieces of advice for entrepreneurs. You know, I think the first thing is just understanding yourself and understanding what you're good at and what you're not as good at, understanding how that affects your decision process kind of going forward. So, you know, when you're thinking about the rest of your founding team, what do they offer that you don't offer, and why are you kind of combining your skill sets together? Knowing where you have gaps and where outside advice, outside mentorship can be really helpful. And think about that not just from your own founding team, right? But I also think about that a lot from who you bring in as an investor and why you might bring that investor in. Are they just kind of doubling down on your own skill set, on your own network, or are you trying to utilize them for something else? So that would probably be the first thing that I would say, is just kind of understand yourself and understand who you are. The second thing that I would say is understand what you want. So making it very clear what your ask is out of people, and that makes it very easy for them to say yes or no. And oftentimes, entrepreneurs just ask for, you know, cash or ask for something like that. If all you want is cash, there are a lot of places to go get cash, right? There's a lot of dumb money out there. That's not what, you know, myself as an investor, you want to think of myself as this smart Stanford guy wants to hear, right? So even if you do think I'm just dumb money, at least pretend like you think that I'm smart money. At least pretend like you did some homework about what value you think I could add versus the other thousands of investors you could be talking to. I think the third piece of advice I want to give everybody is, and it's kind of two parts of the same thing. One is, unless your company completely sucks, this is the cheapest your company's ever going to be, right? And then along with that, you really should be betting on yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, how's anybody else going to believe on it? And what those two pieces kind of come together to mean in my mind is that you should be trying to raise less money at a lower valuation, get it done quickly, and move on, right? Everybody talks about these long fundraising processes, and especially this environment, right? You should be betting on yourself that you can build something meaningful that is going to unlock itself naturally, you know, that you're going to be able to come back in 6 months or 9 months, and everybody's going to be dying to get into your investment.
I love that. This is almost like contrarian Ali advice here in the most recent markets. Like, yeah. Awesome.
And, you know, I see a lot of companies that like are trying to raise for 2 years or 3 years and they're 3 weeks old or they're 6 weeks old. Like, dude, like if you've only been around for 6 weeks, how am I going to bet on you for 2 years? Right? Like, I'll bet on you for 12 weeks maybe, but then wow. I want you to also be a little bit desperate. I want you to be a little bit hungry. I want you to really try to struggle to figure out if what you're building is really adding value to people and to people's lives, right? And then once you have that, once people believe in that, more and more people will come in and want to invest, right? So if you are coming to me right away with some huge, crazy ask that's going to give you funding for 3 years, I usually have to say no matter how much I like you. It just doesn't make sense because you're not betting on yourself. And I can't bet on somebody who can't bet on themselves.
This was home run advice. Like, that was this is an awesome way to finish that. Because it's first of all, it's healthy. So when I'm using the word contrarian almost in a sarcastic way, like, it's healthy business operating advice. that anybody would have given anybody at most points along the last 50 years. Only in these weird, like, strange times that we've lived in has advice like that sounded crazy.
Yeah, it shouldn't. It's fundamental things.
It's very fundamental, right? I mean, headline people, if you didn't hear him say it, he's going to say it's this raise less, like, right? Like, raise less and raise it faster, get it closed and move on. I mean, like, hey, what are your goals? What are the next milestones? What is the next thing you need to get to? Raise the money to get you there. Prove it, build it, spread it. And like, more love is going to find you. It's awesome.
And part of it, again, is if you are raising less and you're doing it at a lower valuation, you can be pickier about who you let in. You can get the right people around you, right? Like, when people go and create a bidding war or whatever, and it gets out of hand, you might lose out on people who could actually add value to you.
Yep,
and the biggest thing you should be thinking about right now in the early stages of your fundraise is who can add the most value to me, and who can bring that outside network, who can bring that outside perspective, who can unlock the most doors. And, you know, the people that are usually willing to overpay, it's because they don't add the other values, right? So they're not going to add the other values to you.
Absolute gold. From Virginia, Minnesota to Stanford to everywhere on the planet in between to the beaches of Puerto Rico, Ali is just dropping wisdom today, which I absolutely am grateful for. Buddy, it's been a pleasure. You know I'm a fan. You've known I'm a fan for like a year or so. I can't wait to see the next 7 years unfold for you. Thank you for your story. Thank you for like giving people some insight into who this like, you know, weird kid, nerdy kid who wasn't sure what he was going to be great at, like, but thrust himself into like a big pool with bigger people and people from all over the place. You bet on yourself when you were 17, 18 years old and you chose Stanford and you took full advantage of it, it sounds like, which is just awesome. So how do listeners find First Check Ventures or find you on social media and connect with you? Or investors, we may have investors who want to get into the syndicate. How do they find you?
Yeah, LinkedIn is the easiest way. It's just Ali, I think it's Mr. Ali Jamal, or you just look up Ali Jamal. It looks like me.
And, I was going to say, look for the guy that looks like you, right?
And or Ali Jamal, First Check Ventures, it should be pretty easy to find me. You know, I do try to respond to everybody that messages me. I can't, you know, always guarantee it, but I do my best.
It's because you're relational. You're not transactional, buddy. That's it. That's awesome. Hey, absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on today. I'm in your corner. Anything we can ever do to help you succeed, you know how to find me. And thanks for coming on and sharing your story with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is really great.
As always, we thank you so much for listening. Today's show was recorded in Los Angeles and produced by Deanna Bernal in Mexico City. You can always find, like, follow, subscribe, and share our show via any popular podcasting platform, as well as find us on social media at Mentors Today. And if you'd like to connect with our host, you can find Rob at I Am Rob Ryan on just about any social media platform. Gracias, and thank you.